Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. I've been off for the last week, and I had all kinds of plans for using this podcast to catch up on all the things that happened over the last week. And think about all the things that did happen. I mean, you actually had Nikki Haley put out a tweet that was mildly critical of the president with eye-rolling emojis, which in Trump world is pretty dramatic. And of course, she was immediately excommunicated. I think it was Andrew Eger who made the point that in Trump world, you don't actually bank goodwill by looking the other way or by being complicit. The moment you break, you're out. Well, we'll see where that goes. And of course, the president had comments about his friends in North Korea, Hong Kong, his ongoing attacks on Democratic congressmen, et cetera, et cetera. But of course, all of that was swept away by the events over the weekend. The terrible tragedy in Dayton, Ohio, and in El Paso. And then, of course, the president's comments this morning, where for the first time he explicitly did condemn, at least the use the term white supremacy. So who better to talk about this than our good friend Peter Wehner, whose book, you know, once again seems awfully timely, The Death of Politics, How to Heal Our Frayed Republic After Trump. So thanks for joining us again, Peter.
It's great to be on, Charlie. It's always a pleasure.
So you're going to have to add a couple extra chapters for it because the Republic is even more frayed than when you actually wrote this. So let's talk for a moment about, well, let's just start with the president's comments this morning, because I wrote the newsletter this morning. This is a president who will never heal us. That of all of the things that Donald Trump is incapable of doing, this would certainly be one of them. The president did use the words condemning bigotry, condemning hatred, condemning white supremacy. So did he do what he had to do?
Well, yes and no. I mean, he said what one would hope that a president would say at a moment like this. The trouble is that it's not just what he says or what the president says, but who says it and what moral authority do they have to say those words? And the problem here is that it's not simply that Donald Trump can't heal us, and your piece today was very good and wise. But this is a man who spends virtually every day of his presidency dividing us, deepening the wounds, creating greater antipathy, greater ethnic and racial hatred for one another. And so in a sense, I had the feeling that his words today were a repudiation of his entire presidency, and that they were words that were essentially false words, that they were written for him by somebody else. Again, I'm glad that he said it, but coming from him and given his record, they're not persuasive. And if I know my Donald Trump, they're not going to last. This is a person who has to be on the attack all the time. And my guess is that within a matter of hours or a matter of days, he's going to go on a tweet storm, attacking the media, attacking Democrats, attacking others. Because that is the only mode that he knows, and he's going to do what comes instinctively and naturally to him, which is to divide us, to deepen the hatred, to deepen the acrimony, to deepen the antipathy. So I think this is going to be seen as a brief parenthesis, a very, very brief parenthesis.
Well, I agree, and this is something that I was sort of yelling at the television set. Remember what happens over the next 24, 48 hours and the patterns that we've learned from Donald Trump after he's read the words that he's given that he's supposed to read. Look, I mean, whatever he said is going to be overwhelmed by two things. Number one, who he is, as you point out, you know, everything that he has done as president. And of course, it's going to be erased by what he's going to say or do in the next 24 or 48 hours. I actually thought that it didn't even rise to the level of repudiation. It was just sort of an irrelevancy to his presidency, because he said the words, you know, white supremacy. And of course, that may provide enough cover for some Republicans to say, well, see, the president denounced bigotry. We're all against bigotry. We're all against hatred. Well, what is the content of that? What does he mean by white supremacy? You had someone who put out a manifesto saying that he drove to El Paso because he wanted to murder Hispanics who were invaders. Now, where did the term invader come from? Where does the term invasion come from? Who's been talking about members of minority groups infesting the country? Who has given oxygen to the people who believe that minorities are going to replace us? So the terminology was there, but does Donald Trump understand that when you demonize members of minority groups, when you stereotype them, when you cast them as the outside other threat, and you use those divisions to build your identity and to polarize the electorate, that is exactly the disease that we're up against. But see, Donald Trump can't acknowledge his own complicity in that, or the way in which his language has contributed. You know, look, he didn't pull the trigger, and I think it's important to say that he's not responsible for the actual act, but he has certainly validated the hatreds and these prejudices that have led to this violence.
Yeah, I think that's a very good way to put it. I mean, it's I agree with you. I've always been resistant, and to this day am, and I think always will be, to link political speech to specific acts of ruthless mass killings. That's just a fraught exercise, and if you're dealing with diseased minds, you don't know what's going to trigger it, and that is important to say. And the responsibility for these killings is with the killer himself. That said, even if these mass killings had not happened, what Donald Trump has done is deeply irresponsible and reckless. He has, on a constant basis since before his presidency began and since his presidency began, dehumanized people, used rhetoric that is cruel and crude. You know, the press is giving a lot of play, and I think rightfully so, from that speech that he gave in Palm City Beach, Florida, where in the course of his speech, he said, "How do you stop these people?" And there was a shouted answer, "Shoot them." And Trump smiled and replied, "Only in the panhandle can you get away with that statement." But the question is, does that kind of thing just stay there? And what does it say about a president or any individual that he would smile with a response like that, and that he would take delight in it? And as you said, he's used unbelievably dehumanizing rhetoric, referring to undocumented immigrants as thugs and animals, and this is an invasion of a country. That creates a climate. Now, whether you can say that that particular climate led to a particular act, that's impossible to know, certainly at this stage. But what you can say is that doing that is an unbelievably reckless thing. It's wrong for anybody to do it. It's particularly wrong for a president of the United States to do it, because that is the one person that we've all voted for. And at times like this, at moments of tragedy and grief and crisis, he is the one voice, or she is the one voice, that we look to. Try and speak to the nation, and to speak to our better angels, and to talk about sympathy and compassion, and to raise our sights to things that are higher and nobler and better. And Donald Trump is incapable of doing that, and indeed he does the opposite. And you know, democracy depends on a culture of words. And maybe this, I'm probably biased to some extent because I'm a writer and I've been a presidential speechwriter. So, you know, I've had a love of words since I was a young boy. But you think about the power of words, you know, the lyrics of your favorite songs, your favorite books, your favorite poems, the letters you receive from loved ones. They have a tremendous power to capture the imagination, to touch the human soul, to move the human heart. Even if you think of the greatest presidents in American history, often people think of them not primarily for what they've done, but for what they said. So Thomas Jefferson, many fewer Americans think about the Louisiana Purchase than they did that all men are created equal. Or Abraham Lincoln, they don't think so much about the Homestead Act. They think about with malice toward none, with charity to all. With John F. Kennedy, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. They think of that probably more than they think of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Or Ronald Reagan, you know, rather than his tax reform in 1986, more people would, I think, identify with take down this wall, Mr. Gorbachev. There's a reason for that, because everybody knows on some intuitive level that those words have – that words have power, and words of president have particular power to heal or to enrage, to lift us up or to pull us down, to elevate or degrade. And if you have a president using words in a weaponized way against opponents and against the other, driving the sort of populist anger, that's just very dangerous territory, very reckless.
Well, and as Phil Rucker wrote in the Washington Post, after yet another mass slaying, the question surrounding the president is no longer whether he will respond, as other presidents once did, but whether his words contributed to the carnage. And as you point out, you know, people are going to remember, you know, coming down that golden escalator and describing Mexicans as rapists, describing immigrants as thugs and animals, the way in which he uses the language of invasion and infestation. And what's interesting is that I reread the statement, the rather extraordinary statement from the National Cathedral last week, which I think was titled, you know, have we lost our sense of shame? Which is something with it was playing off the McCarthy hearings. Have right. you at long last? And right. they specifically talked about how this language of dehumanization could lead to violence. And given the combustible nature of our society, these disaffected young, overwhelmingly white, you know, males who are sitting in their, you know, in the basement on the internet to patrol, you know, being radicalized in this particular way, and the kind of thrill of excitement they must feel to see their thing, their themes and their rhetoric echoed by the president of the United States. I mean, I don't know how you feel about this, but I started off having mixed feelings about whether we should read the manifesto of the killer in El Paso, and ultimately decided that it's silly not to, because it's sort of willful ignorance not to read it, because to understand that this is an ideology that we are facing, that it's a cop out to just say it's mental illness. And when you pick this thing up and you read it, and the first line basically is, not exactly the first line, but this attack is a response to the Hispanic invasion of Texas. They are the instigators, not me. I am simply defending my country from cultural and ethnic replacement brought on by an invasion. Now, does that sound familiar to anybody? And then he goes on to critique the Democrats, how they are pandering, and if the Democrats succeed, this will be a one-party state, and they'll start to win elections in Texas. And I'm thinking, wow, this is extremist, bizarre rhetoric. But you don't have to go on to 8chan to hear these kinds of themes, do you?
No, you don't. And I think you're right. I think it is important to read that manifesto for the reasons you stated. I have not read it yet, but I will. And I was familiar with some of what was in there. And I think you're quite right. I mean, this white supremacist domestic terrorism is rising. It's a real threat to the country, and we have to treat it like we did with militant Islam, you know, in the administration that I worked in the early 2000s. And what that requires is that the apparatus of government has to be focused in on this and try to figure out what needs to be done. There's a whole range of issues that you have to look at, from gun violence to internet and radicalization to mental health. It's a complicated mix. There's no obvious solution to it. I have a feeling these days that bringing out the issue of mental health, which is a very real issue, has to be taken into account. But I'm getting a sense on the right, it's a kind of, I don't know, not quite a conversation stopper, but it's maybe the shield that they think that can defend them, you know, from some of these other issues. The issue of mental health and what you do about it when it comes to shooters is enormously complicated. Obviously, most people who have issues with mental health are not killers. And how do you determine which people are going to be killers and not? The president today talked about, you know, potentially locking people up in advance. But how do you know that?
And, yeah, I know.
I mean, these are all very, very serious issues that we have to look at. But there is such a thing as the mobilization of a government behind great causes or important causes, urgent causes. And I know when we were in the Bush administration how much we did from stem to stern to reorient the government's policy to try and protect us against another attack. And if you had been in the White House or at the national security agencies at the end of 2001, the FBI, CIA, and all of the chatter that was going on, you know, the people that really followed that stuff were virtually certain that we were going to be hit again. We felt we were so exposed and there was so little that we knew. But the government geared itself up to try and confront this violence, and it's largely succeeded. And we're seeing this now with the white nationalists and the domestic violence, and we have to have a similar kind of commitment.
No, we do. You know, and I was thinking about the fears after 9/11, and I remember thinking that the most devastating sort of attack on America would be terrorists who would go to a place like Mall of America and just shoot innocent civilians randomly. And of course, that never happened, except it did, but it wasn't jihadists. It actually has happened, and it is white nationalists, and it's taken us so long to gear up for this. Now, I am not an expert on the law, but I was hearing one expert saying, look, one of the things we have to do is we have to have a federal law about domestic terrorism. And right now, we have an international terrorism law, and the FBI is empowered to do all sorts of things in defense of the country against international terrorism, but they're not empowered to do things about domestic terrorism like what we are confronting right now. So, and this almost seems like a cliche to say, but you know what the reaction of the country would have been had these been Muslim terrorists who were shooting up El Paso. We know what the president would have done. We know what Republicans would have done. And yet here we are faced with this massive carnage and this tragedy, this almost incalculable tragedy, and we haven't figured out what to do about it. Okay, so I want to talk about the other issue, and let me explain to you briefly why this is one of those subjects. The day after, I was a talk show host, as you know, for more than 23 years. And the shows that I hated the most, and hate's a strong word, but it reflects exactly how I felt about it, were the shows the day after these mass shootings. And I want to walk back to what I always thought the day after those. But let's do this right after this. Today's podcast is brought to you by the Ultimate Sleep Machine. Look at the world's top tech leaders and high-growth startup CEOs, and I bet you wonder, how in the world they have that kind of inexhaustible energy to do what they do? And the answer might surprise you. The latest trend with top tech leaders is sleep optimization. While most Americans aren't getting the sleep they need, tech founders and CEOs are optimizing their sleep to perform at peak levels every day. The first step, the Pod by 8 Sleep, the ultimate sleep machine. The Pod is the first and only high-tech bed designed to help you achieve peak mind and body performance. So are you looking to sleep deeper? The Pod dynamically adjusts the temperature on each side of the bed so you're comfortable all night. Do you want to know your sleep intel? The Pod tracks your biometrics while you sleep with no need for wearable technology. Do you want to sleep better? Enjoy personalized programs and coaching designed by experts guiding you towards true sleep fitness. Because the better you sleep, the better you everything. Try the Pod for 100 nights, and if you don't love it, we'll refund your purchase and arrange for a free pickup, only at 8sleep.com/bulwark. Now, they already sold out their first two batches, so they're going fast. For a limited time, get $150 off your purchases. That's $150 off your purchase when you go to 8sleep.com/bulwark. That's EIGHTsleep.com/bulwark. Okay, we're back with Peter Weiner. Peter, I was just telling you about when I was a talk show host. These were the days that I just dreaded because the conversations always seemed to be exactly the same. And they always seemed to end up in exactly the same place. You would have the preening, the posturing, the cliches leading up to the absolutely predictable inaction that nothing would happen. And I'll tell you, one of the things that I felt broke my spirit, I can still remember that week, where I basically said, listen, you know what? I'm sick of this. I can't take this anymore. I really don't want to talk about it, which was right after Newtown, after all those little children were killed. And I just did not want to open up the phone lines and hear the usual NRA cliches about guns and all the Second Amendment stuff. I just didn't want to go through that kabuki dance of hypocrisy and repetition. So, and this feels like it has that element because you know that nothing has actually changed on the politics of guns. Nothing will be done on guns. This feels like it might be different because of the shock of the hatred, the recognition that we face a new enemy, the fact that we are in this dangerous combustible moment. Do you feel that there's something slightly different about this?
Yeah, that's a very interesting critique. I'm not sure. Let me begin by saying that I completely share your feelings in the past, and mine were exactly the same. And I wouldn't actually want to watch television or listen to the shows. I always had the feeling that these human lives that had been lost and the grief and the immense, immeasurable sorrow that the families and the friends of these people were going through, there wasn't any time for people to grieve before the victims had become pawns in a political war for both sides. And I remember being struck at an early age, and how this has played out time and time again, how it's not actually simply grief at the loss of life. It's that certain people, liberals and conservatives, react to those loss of life with varying degrees of horror, depending on whether it advances their cause or not.
That's so true.
And if people die, and it's from gun violence, then liberals will speak out, and conservatives will go quiet. And if it was an attack by militant Islam, it would be the opposite. And it just sort of dawned in you that this is not an authentic human reaction to grief. It's trying to use those lives as a vehicle to advance a cause. Now, to be fair, the people who are advocating the cause believe in the cause, and they want to try and deal with the violence and the loss and all of the rest. But that always bothered me. Are we at a different moment? I don't know. I've on and off studied this issue of gun violence and what can we do about it. And I'd be curious about your thoughts on it. My sense of it is that if you really wanted to make dramatic difference in gun violence, you would have to be able to put into effect policies that are simply impossible in America. You've talked about the Australian example, the British example, the confiscation of guns. You can do that in certain countries that doesn't have a gun culture and doesn't have 300 million guns. We do. And so there's an enormous amount of energy and intensity spent debating issues that at best will have the most marginal effect, whether we're talking about waiting periods or the size of magazines or mental health background checks and all of the rest. And there have been studies done by this, by the CDC and others, assault weapons bans during the Clinton years. They didn't have an effect. And my sense in this public debate is people are genuinely horrified by what happened and they want to do something about it. But there aren't the means right now to actually deal with these mass shootings. And so the debate is people are talking past each other. I should say that the other thing that's of course important to keep in mind because of the horror of these mass shootings, and they've increased so much, is that violent crime and murder rates have, of course, gone down a huge amount since the early part of the 1990s. But these mass killings have gone up, and they shock the system as they should.
Well, I've gone around and around on all of this, and I understand the emotional impulse: do something. But what would is your legislative fix? Would it be effective? Would it have changed anything? There does seem to be some sort of a consensus, though, that better background checks, universal background checks, would be positive. I do think that these red flag laws need to be considered. At least, let's have a good faith conversation about, if you know somebody is dangerous, can we do something to get guns out of their hands? I don't see any reason why any American civilian should have, what the you know, 100 rounds of, guns with 100 rounds of ammunition in them, like the shooter in Dayton had. I don't know that a ban on assault weapons is going to be effective, but there are certain weapons and there's certain weaponry that just has no purpose in civilian life. And I wish we could have a good faith discussion of that, but I don't see it in the near future at all.
No, I think that's probably right. Look, I support a lot of those things, and it seems to me that a lot of them are common sense measures, and we ought to do them because they might make a difference. But my understanding, I'm no expert on this issue, but my understanding of it when various agencies like the CDC and so forth have looked into this, that they would make a marginal difference. And I remember the great social scientist James Q. Wilson, who wrote, among other things, a terrific book on crime called Crime and Human Nature in the 1980s with Richard Herrnstein. And you know, and Wilson basically said that a lot of these laws wouldn't have much of an effect, and you have to put on the counter on the other side of the scale people who carry weapons that they brandish and prevent crimes from happening. Now, again, I'm sympathetic to a lot of these gun control measures, and I think that they're certainly consistent with the Heller decision in 2010, and Justice Scalia said they should. And I would just be rigorously empirical, which, of course, is conservatives, you and I, that used to be a hallmark of conservatism, which is what works and what are the facts and circumstances. And so I think we should examine all of these things. Everything ought to be on the table. But you know, part is back to Donald Trump and the role of the presidency. Part of it is to promote solutions and to champion, and not just to pull out a list of wishes that you're not going to put any energy behind. But the other thing that has to happen or should happen is that presidents and political leaders do need to speak to this moment, and they need to talk about what we need to be as a country. And as Bobby Kennedy said in a speech shortly after Martin Luther King Jr. was killed in Cleveland, that, you know, you're not enriched or ennobled by hatred and revenge. And that kind of thing is important to the life of a country as well. And that is missing in this day and time.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I'd actually written down that I wanted to mention that to you. You sent that out. You sent that over this morning. And I sat and watched, and I said to my wife, I said, you know what's really striking watching this speech by Bobby Kennedy is first of all, how different it is from the rhetoric of our own time. To listen to somebody who is – and there are some things that he said that I disagreed with, but he said it, and it was intelligent, it was eloquent, it was emotional, and it was deeply principled. And that's the kind of rhetoric that we don't have. And you're right. There is a kind of a spiritual sickness that we have right now, a kind of madness. There's a subculture that's developed that is not going to be solved by even by legislation that effectively deals with the hardware or with the internet. And part of it does, you know, is going to require a certain moral suasion, which is why the routine denunciation of, you know, white nationalism, white supremacy, which is necessary, is not sufficient, because you have to go to that question of who we are as a country. And I think part of it is we are not a country that demonizes people because of the color of their skin or where they came from or what language they speak. And unfortunately, I think in the last 2 weeks, Donald Trump has made it clear that demonization is central to his presidency and is central to his appeal, and that he intends to make it a focal point of his 2020 reelection. And I think you're right, going back to the very beginning of this podcast, where you said that his comments today, Monday, are going to be sort of a blip, because this whole sense of us versus them, that you have to be afraid of these people, that these people need to go back where they came from, that somehow they are lesser Americans, is not peripheral to Trumpism. It's the beating heart of Trumpism.
Yeah, no, that's very well said. I'll say a couple of things on that. The first is that Yeah, I said to a friend a long time ago that with Donald Trump, there's no bottom. And when there's no bottom, there's no bottom. And I can virtually guarantee you that as this 2020 campaign moves forward and heats up, it's going to get worse and worse and worse. And we're going to have to figure out as a country and as journalists and as citizens how we handle it as he is committed to divide us and to stoke the embers of hatred, ethnic nationalism, racial animosity, and all the rest. You know, how do we deal with it? But we know it's coming, and we have to be prepared for it. And the other thing is, you know, apropos that Bobby Kennedy speech, which I think it was in April 5th, I think it was at the Cleveland City Club. And it is a beautiful speech. You know, one is reminded about, again, the importance of rhetoric. And at this moment in the life of our country, this nation is inflamed. There's an inflammation in the body politic, and the people are viewing those with whom they disagree not as wrong, but as malicious and malevolent. It's not just that other people are opponents, but they're enemies. And we've got to find somebody eventually who can give voice to decency and sympathy. Because that matters. There is – it's an amorphous area, but there is such a thing as an ethic in a country, a cultural ethos that defines a people. And we know the power of words and the power of language to elevate or degrade. And the role of a president is important. It's not everything. Most of life is lived in individual lives, and how you deal with neighbors and friends and colleagues. That's where the stories and the chapters are written. But presidents make an enormous amount of difference, and we have one that is as committed to division as we've ever had in the history of this country.
And I hate now to go back to the political calculation here, but I was one of the talking heads that said that I didn't think that Trump was engaging in fourth dimensional chess with his attacks on the Squad or on Elijah Cummings, but that he had a certain lizard cunning, that he understood what would resonate with his base, and that he also understands that it doesn't matter whether he loses by 90 percentage points in New York and in California, he's going to have to win in places like Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, etc. And that these themes, which may horrify much of the rest of the country, might actually play with that white Trumpist base that would understand what he was appealing to. So I understand why he thought he was winning that, why he relished that fight. But today you see the flip side of this and the nightmare for Republicans, because once you play with racism in that particular way, stoke it in order to get your base fired up, you create the dynamic that I think that we're seeing today, which is the rest of the country just absolutely horrified by all of this and the number of votes they will lose. I am not a wonk on Texas politics, but people who are way smarter than me are saying, Republicans really ought to start worrying about places like Texas. You've had now four Republican incumbent congressmen who've announced that they are not running for re-election. If Texas flips and becomes a and becomes a Democratic state, the Republican Party is wiped out nationally for a very long time.
Yeah, I agree with that analysis. I think lizard cunning is an apt way to describe what Donald Trump has, and this notion that he's playing four-dimensional chess when the rest of us are playing checkers is ludicrous. He's volatile. He's impulsive. He does – I will give him this. He does have almost supernatural sense of what will resonate with his base. But the problem is that base is limited in size. It's deeply and intensely committed to him, and it will turn out. But this idea that this kind of racial animosity and race baiting and all of the rest is a winning political strategy strikes me as absurd. If any other president, given the state of the economy and many of the objective conditions in the country right now, would be a heavy favorite, virtually a lock for re-election, he is not. And if you really dive into the data, as people like Ron Brownstein and others have done, you see that this kind of racialist rhetoric is hurting him. You know, I live in the 10th district, congressional district in Virginia, which used to be Barbara Comstock's district. And that was a perfect illustration of where the Republicans got wiped out in 2018. In 2016, Hillary Clinton won that district by, I think, about 3 points or so. And Barbara won the election. She's a Republican by 6 points or so. In 2018, she lost by double digits. And this was not because she had changed. It was because this was the Trump undertow. And there are just not enough white supremacists and racists and people with a deep animosity that he can appeal to. Now, the question, and it's an open question, is whether the Democratic Party in their embrace of radical politics, whether it's the Green New Deal to Medicare for All to reparations to all of the rest, decide to make this a close election by coming up with deeply unpopular policies. But in terms of Trump himself, he has positioned himself to be beaten. The question is whether the Democrats are foolish enough to embrace a candidate that would allow him to win. But we've had this conversation before. My belief is that viruses can create their own antibodies, and that my hope is that that this country, after the virus of Donald Trump, will decide that there are certain virtues like honor and decency that are worth reclaiming.
You know, we're in a strange moment in history when Bill Maher is the voice of reason.
Yeah.
And on his show last week, he said all the Democrats have to do to win is come off less crazy than Trump. And of course, they're blowing it.
Yeah, right.
Coming across as unserious people who are going to take away all of your money so that migrants from Honduras can go to college for free and get a major in America sucks. But, okay. I'm hoping that they're paying attention to all of that. Okay. I'm going to bring up something that one of the things that I felt most grateful about being on vacation last week was that I did not have to answer the point I'm going to raise right now, which you do not have to answer, but I want to try out a reaction to this because it's such a horrible story. And it's the story of the tape of Ronald Reagan talking to Richard Nixon. See, you're groaning inside already, aren't you? Because we're all like, oh, this, don't make this do this. But it's a tape from 1971. In which Reagan is talking about ambassadors to the United Nations. It's horrible. It's just there's no rationalization. And his daughter Patty Davis said that if he was alive, he would ask for forgiveness, and was totally inconsistent with his character. But one of the things that struck me about it was, and I don't think that was a genuine reflection of Ronald Reagan. I mean, none of us are all good or all evil. This was one of his worst moments, but that was not something that we as a country or a party had to confront and embrace at the time. Let's imagine that he'd said these words in public. We were not required to think that they were nothing. We were not required to look the other way or to accept or engage in whataboutism. Had they been said in public, I don't think that he ever would have been nominated. I don't think he would have been elected. And the Republicans would not have found a way to rationalize that this kind of rhetoric was okay. Which is so different from what Trump is doing to us, what he is forcing us to rationalize and accept. And I think that's what makes this so particularly toxic. It's one thing that people said awful things in private and that we did not know about versus saying it in their out loud voice and then requiring some sort of acquiescence.
Yes, I think that's right about what you say about Reagan. It was a horrible thing to say, and it was kind of a gut punch to those of us who have admired Ronald Reagan. In my case, I worked in his administration. It's not the sum total of the man by any means. You have to take people into the totality of their acts and overall in the totality of his acts. Ronald Reagan was, as a human being as well as a president, a very admirable person. I'll say a couple of things about it. One of my first reactions was how it must feel if you are an African American and you hear that. To know that this is how two former presidents were referring to blacks. It's 1971. It wasn't that long ago, and to think that that is how a lot of people, white people, have viewed them then and view them now, and I just think it's important for people, those of us who are white, to understand that there is a different experience for African Americans. And when those things come out, we're shocked by it. And I wonder if a lot of them think, you know, this isn't a shock to us. This is how a lot of white people think. So that was one reaction that I had. The second one is what you said, which is it was said quietly. He would never have said it publicly, and that's a really big deal. You know, George Will, I did an interview with him. I did an Atlantic essay on George and his new book, The Conservative Sensibility. And I asked him about something he said about Donald Trump in a comparison with Richard Nixon. And he said that he thought that Donald Trump was going to do more damage than Nixon ever did because you can't unring the bell. And I pressed George on what he meant by that. And he said that Nixon did a cover-up of a surreptitious burglary, but he never challenged the standards. Ultimately, he was done in by the standards. He didn't destroy the norm. He violated the norm. And when it was found out that he violated the norm, he knew he was wrong, and his party knew he was wrong, and they got rid of him. Where Trump is very, very different is he's a person who's shattering the norms. He's challenging the standards, the moral standards. That's just very, very different. And what you said is also really significant, I think. Donald Trump is a wreck of a human being. I think he has a disordered personality. He's obviously sad in many, many respects. I get upset and angered at him because of his cruelty and the dehumanization. He's really like a bully. The damage that he does to people. But he is a person who is so wrecked on so many different levels that I suppose at this point we've just got to come to accept that that's what we're dealing with here. And, you know, my dad told me years ago, I think about this with Trump when it comes to folks who say, you know, talk to him about ethics or about human decency. And my dad said years ago to me, he said in trying to explain how some people simply can't understand certain concepts, he said, it's like trying to explain to a person born blind what color is. You just can't do it. And I think when it comes to morality, ethics, sympathy, compassion, Donald Trump simply is incapable of feeling those things. Where the real damage is being done, and where in a certain way there's an enormous amount of disappointment and even pain, is that the party that you and I were a part of, and the movement that we were a part of for so many years, have, in hitching their wagon to Trump, are now complicit in this whole enterprise. So many people know better. And as you said, they're forced to rationalize this. And that they made a bet early on where they thought that Trump was containable and controllable. You remember the language even after the Wisconsin primary when he basically sewed up the nomination. There was this belief. I think it was wishful thinking because I thought it was absurd, as you did at the time, which is that he would grow in office, that he had to use certain tactics to win the nomination. But once he became president, the presidency would change him. And that didn't happen. He's changed the presidency, but he's also changed the Republican Party and the American right. And when they decided to hitch their wagon to him, they didn't know that they were already, you know, they were hitching their wagon to one that was going down and down and down. And that sort of you know, figurative deal with the devil has come back to haunt them. And the way that people have accommodated themselves, things that they would have been horrified by, wouldn't have accepted 2 years ago, they don't even bat an eye anymore. And that's how these things happen. And to see the Republican Party, which was, of course, an imperfect party and has certain things to answer for, but has also a tremendous history and some tremendous achievements. And to see what it was and now the wreckage of what it is difficult.
Yeah, I think I've been misunderstood when I've said that I've gotten to a point where Donald Trump himself is a given and doesn't bother me that much anymore. What bothers me much more is what he's doing to us than right. and the way that he is making it. And I think that's the point that Will is making and I was trying to make about Reagan is and you're making as well is the adjustment of our moral standards and how hard it's going to be to recover. Peter Winter, thanks so much for joining us again. I appreciate it very, very much.
I always enjoy the conversation. Thanks, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast, which was brought to you today by the Ultimate Sleep Machine. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.